First of all, I want to thank everybody for coming. Coming back to the Kollel is basically coming home. I wouldn't say I grew up at the Kollel, but we spent many, many years here at the Kollel learning, being involved with the community. And I want to thank everybody who continues to be involved in the Kollel and attends classes and shiurim and learns at the Kollel. And wish the Kollel many more prosperous, successful years in the community. I'm going to speak for a few minutes, as Rabbi Oren mentioned, about rabbis in Chicago. And I was faced with a dilemma of who do I pick? Who do we talk about? Now, originally, when I first got the idea to even research the rabbis of Chicago, it was, well, was there even anybody here? Was there rabbis in Chicago, like in, you know, 1920? Like, that didn't exist. Like, of course, no. And no, there was no rabbi. The answer is there was a tremendous number of rabbonim and rabbis who were world-renowned scholars and sages from ages. And we could go on for hours and hours talking almost about each one of them. A lot of the problem is that over the course of time, the information that we know about them, many of it dissipates. People who knew them are not around anymore. Family members, you know, many times are hard to contact and to get a hold of. Many rabbanim did, many rabbanim didn't write svarim. So we're going to talk about that a little bit. Let's just mention a little bit, how did I get interested in the topic of the rabbanim? And it really comes down to two people. One is, it's really Rabbi Moshe Kushner and Yibara L'chaim, Shebi Zalka Terufu Shleima, Harav Gedalia Schwartz. A number of years ago, probably close to 25 years ago, Rabbi Schwartz gave a series of shiurim at our alma mater, at the Skokie Yeshiva, and throughout the community, on halachic history in America, where he dissected a number of different areas of halacha through the prism and the perspective of rabbis, or we could call them early rabbis in America, and what they had to say about these uniquely American questions. And in his own unique way, every time Rabbi Schwartz would mention a Rav, he would mention a tremendous amount of biographical information about them. And Rabbi Kushner asked if I could help. They were publishing a book in his honor. They were honoring him at the dinner. The CRC was, and he asked if I could help prepare those shiurim from the tapes and from the ksavim, from his handwriting. And as I listened to the tapes, I noticed that Rabbi Schwartz would mention a number of facts about the rabbanim, but it wasn't in the format which was able to be printed. It needed demanded a little bit more research. And I got into I learned a system into how to learn about and how to research and find out about rabbanim. And that could come from another different ways. So we'll leave that aside. But after the project was done, I came to the realization that there's actually a number of svarim and books out there that gather that information together, and can be used as a source guide to read a little bit about rabbanim. You know, very short snippets of things. There's a sefer from the 50s, 60s, Toldos Anshei Shem. That has a little bit more of the Chicago Rabbanim, but it's not only Chicago Rabbanim. There's a tremendous two-volume set called Hebrew Printing in America from someone named Goldman, where he goes through a lot of the Hebrew printing. But again, all of these books, Chachma Yisrael of New England, all of these books, nothing. I couldn't believe it. I said, there's so many Gedolim who stepped through Chicago, spent many years in Chicago. There isn't a book sourced primarily on that. There were two books, a number of others as well. There's a book by Hyman Midas from 24. It's a big, it's bigger than this. It's a little bit bigger than this. Big book, but again, his perspective, he does mention some of the Rabbanim, but he doesn't come from the Frum Orthodox perspective. So we thought that gathering this information together from the perspective of from people would be a benefit. So my next problem that I had was for today's lecture a little bit. Who are we going to talk about, or who are we not going to talk about? No matter how I sliced it, you know, the biggest and the greatest, right? There's not enough time. You know, the number of the people who walk through the halls of Chicago, you know, I'm not even gonna pull out who we could speak about. So I had an idea. I said, you know what? I'm gonna let the time speak for itself. Let's pick 1 year, and we'll speak about who was here in Chicago during that 1 year, and whoever it is. That means a number of Rabbanim we're not going to be able to speak about, but okay, that's just the way that it is. And we're not going to be able to even give full justice to the Rabbanim that we have here, but let's do a little bit. And it's at least basically a little bit alphabetical. So again, what happened in 1917 in Chicago? Something similar to what happened now, 100 years later, sort of. 1917, the White Sox won the World Series. The Chicago at that time was about 30 years post-fire, had recovered. It's becoming one of the larger major cities in America. Meatpacking was one of their very big businesses, at least for the Jewish meatpacking industry. Even the non-Jewish meatpacking industry, the stockyards, it was there. Now, don't think that just because I'm presenting Rabbanim that all of the Yidden in Chicago during the early days were frum. It didn't happen. It wasn't so. I mean, we wish it would be, and we wish that will be, but that wasn't the case. There was a lot of not religious people, and that progressive, you know, kind of change, which again is not the topic for discussion in looking at the religiosity of the Jews in Chicago and what the factors were that affected, you know, where they were, where they came from, what happened afterwards. Why is it that if we had so many great Rabbanim that there was seemingly a period of downtime before the resurgence of Torah here in Chicago? But let's move on a little bit. Again, we're focusing here on 1917. In 1917, one of the Zakin HaRabbonim, the primary Rabbonim here in Chicago, was Rabbi Shimon Album. Okay, Rabbi Shimon Album. Before I started, I never heard of Rabbi Shimon Album. Who's Rabbi Shimon Album? Now, well, let's go a little bit. We know a little bit about him, right? Rabbi Shimon Album in 1917 had been in Chicago already for 28 years. So he was 68 years old at that time. He was born in 1849 near Kovna. He learned in Volozhin Yeshiva. His brother was Rabbi David Tzvi Katzen Allenbogen, the Rav of St. Petersburg in Russia. Rabbi Album himself survived a number of pogroms in Europe. I just can't read my notes.
Which shul
was he? Oh, so we'll get to which shul he was. I can't read my notes exactly. Rav Meir Simcha of Divinsk said that Rav Album, had he stayed in Europe, would be considered among the greatest Rabbanim in the entire of Europe, in all of Europe. Where did Rabbi Album become the Rav? In 1890, he came to Chicago and became the Rav of the shul called Mishneh Gemara. Now, we know Mishneh Gemara is still around. It's still an active shul in Chicago. At the 80th dinner of the Mishneh Gemara shul, they mentioned that of the 17 original shuls from the 40-year period of 1847 to 1887, there was, let's say, 17 original shuls. Only one shul remained from, and that was the Mishneh Gemara shul. Now, just talking about the Mishneh Gemara shul a little bit, the name of the shul describes exactly what the shul was. The shul, as many shuls had, even in Chicago, had a chevra shas, had a group of people who learned a set amount of Gemara and Mishnayos every day. And I one time had a copy of the bylaws of the shul. If you missed the day, you got fined, and you were not allowed to leave in the middle. You're not allowed to leave in the middle, and you could only be on the board if you were a Shomer Shabbos. That was in the bylaws of the shul. Rabbi Album was the Rav HaMachshir, was in charge of kashrus for a number of the four, basically four of the largest meatpacking plants in the city, and this was something that he did without pay. Now, to mention even just quickly the Rav Alba's, Rav Alba, without mentioning what happened in the 2 year period would be entirely remiss. Possibly the greatest Gaon who ever walked into the city of Chicago, the most famous, well-known Rav who ever walked into the city of Chicago, was Rav David Wolofsky, the Ritvaz. The Ritvaz was a world-renowned scholar. He ended up coming to America because he needed to raise funds for his commentary on the Yerushalmi. Okay. Now, just as I mentioned the word Yerushalmi, as an aside, I think it was 1889, there was a Rav, Rav Eliezer Alpertson, who wrote the first commentary on the Yerushalmi published here in Chicago. It was the first Sefer ever printed in America, and it was the first Gemara ever printed in America. A Sefer on the Yerushalmi Maseches Bikurim. So the Ritvaz wrote a world-famous commentary. It's in the most printings of the Yerushalmi. And he was he came around fundraising, and in 1903, he was convinced to come to Chicago to become the chief rabbi of Chicago, to be the chief rabbi of Chicago. The problem was is that not every kehila, or not every group of people agreed to the fact that he was to be the chief rabbi of Chicago. And to put it mildly, there was a great debate, and there was a lot of tension. A lot of it was political, most of it became through the Balabatim, and the tension really ended up becoming a debate between Rabbi Albom and the Ritvaz on basically running of two institutions. One was the Kashrus in the city, and the other one was the yeshiva. They had a small yeshiva which was there, which ended up growing into Yeshiva Seitz Chaim, into the Hebrew Theological College, but the debate under those two things ended up causing that the Ritvaz was forced to leave the city under extreme situations after a little bit more than a year here in Chicago. But just focusing on Rabbi Albom, we can get an idea on who Rabbi Albom was by seeing that he was a Bar Plukta. He was somebody who was able to stand his own against the Ritvaz, the world-renowned scholar who was known throughout the world. That was Rabbi Albom. If you walk into Waldheim Cemetery, now Waldheim Cemetery is, as cemeteries go, is a good place to do research on Rabbanim. You'll get the day they died. You can get the maybe the year they were born. Sometimes you can get a little bit of biographical information on their kever. You can look around to see who their relatives were. Right, it's a good place to do research. And in Chicago, a lot of the Chicago Rabbanim were buried here in Chicago. Rav Albom has what is probably the largest matzeva, the largest oil in the entire, in terms of volume and mass, not the tallest, but the biggest. It's off the beaten track a little bit. It's not like right where the parking lot is, but it's the biggest oil that's there, and it has two large plaques on either side. They're fading. He died on the first day of Shavuos in 1921. They said the Chicago Tribune said that there was over 25,000 people at his funeral. We get an idea on who he was. One thing that he wrote in terms of just a halachic statement, he prided himself in saying that he never wrote a get in Chicago. Not because people didn't get divorced, but because there was such controversy regarding how to properly formulate the text of the get. And how to put those things together, he said he's going to stay away from the machloikis, and he's not going to deal with that. Moving along, we're going to move to somebody who, for whatever reason, he didn't write Sfarim. A lot of the information that we can glean about people, about Rabbanim, about what's going on, you can look in the books. A person wrote a Sefer. You know, you can look at the topic, you can look at the contents of the book. Very often in the introduction, you can learn a lot about the person who wrote the book. In the back, you can look to see who the people who sponsored the book were. There's always a lot of different factors and things you can learn about. Rav Avram Yitzchak Kardon, was someone who didn't, at least seemingly, we couldn't find any writings on him. My first introduction to Rabbi Cardin. I think it's room 11, is that correct? Room 11, right? It's called room 11. Room 11 in the yeshiva, in Skokie Yeshiva, was like, it's like a hall of fame, basically. It's a room off the side of the dining room, and there's large portraits of
it's
all
room 18.
Room 18, thank you. Room 18, thank you. Room 18, thank you. and room 18 has large portraits of all the Rosh Yeshivas of the yeshiva, of Skokie Yeshiva, and there's a large picture, one of the pictures it has underneath it, a plaque. It says, Rabbi Avram Cardin. Who's Rabbi Avram Cardin? Who was he? So Rabbi Avram Cardin in 1917 had been in Chicago 10 years. He was much younger, he was 35 years old. He was born in the suburb of Minsk and learned in Novominsk Yeshiva. He ended up moving to London. He ended up moving to London at a shul called Kahal Machziki Hadas and moved to a shul called Anshei Tikton here in Chicago. After some time, he ended up switching shuls to what was known as the Sawyer Avenue Shul. That was in 1912. He ended up holding that position for 33 years until he was until he was nifter. He walked every day 3.6 miles to shul, to get to shul. He was once rabbed. I wasn't quite clear on this, but the way that it was written up was, it says he was once rabbed at gunpoint, and all of his money, 15 cents, was taken. Okay, so I'm like, wow, 15 cents must have been a lot of money. So I did a research in terms of how much 15 cents was back in 1917. It wasn't that much money, but I guess it must have been, because that's what it was. Rabbi Cardin was known to be a great speaker, a great orator. The language that was used when he passed away, the Yiddish papers said that he was unassuming, studious, uncompromising in his defense of orthodoxy, an undiplomatic champion of strict adherence to Shulchan Aruch without allowing the least bit of modernity into him. Right? Now, by looking at that picture, I wouldn't have thought so. By either of those pictures, right here in the picture on the left, he's sitting with Rabbi Ephraim Epstein in the middle at a banquet. Right? I can't tell you. I'd say he looks like he would have been modern at those times. But in terms of following the Shulchan Aruch, it seems that he said we have to follow the Shulchan Aruch. We can't deviate from the way the Shulchan Aruch said. It seems to be that he was a very emotional person. Obviously, in 1920, there was a fire that burned down the shul, Shari Torah, and he cried. He saw the scene. He burst out into tears. He cried bitterly until he heard that all seven Sifri Torah were saved, and the majority of the Gemaras from the shul were saved, and then he said, okay, he accepted the decree from Shemayim, and the shul moved to another place, Millard Avenue, even though it was still called the Sawyer Avenue Shul. Rabbi Cardin, again, was one of the founders of the yeshiva of Hebrew Theological College, together with Rabbi Saul Silber, together with Rabbi Ephraim Epstein. So that's something that we know at least a little bit about Rabbi Cardin. Moving along, we have Rabbi Yaakov Galinsky. Okay. Now, Rabbi Yaakov Galinsky would not be happy that we called him Rabbi Yaakov Galinsky. He said, I'm not a rabbi in the congregation. I'm Mr. Dolinsky. Mr. Dolinsky. Now, Mr. Dolinsky, or Rabbi Yaakov Dolinsky, moved to Chicago 1890. He was here already for 27 years. He was 62 in 1917. He didn't have a shul. He was the quintessential rebbe. He was the quintessential Rebbe. He stimulated his Talmidim. He nourished his Talmidim. He had a breadth of knowledge throughout all areas that his students felt comfortable asking him a question in any area, and he would answer them no matter what the question was. It's something amazing when you can meet somebody in any field, but especially in Torah, who you can ask them anywhere, and they're able to answer. He said it, you know, that's what he could do. The Ritvaz, that's a quote from the Ritvaz. The Ritvaz said, Rabbi Yaakov Dolinsky is the greatest lamdan in ganz America. is the greatest scholars, the greatest Lamdan in the entire of America. Right? Entire of America, that's coming from the Ritvaz. No small compliment. The Daily Jewish Courier. Again, you should be able to pull up a lot of the archives of these old papers online. There's actually something that I used. I didn't know. I probably when I started doing the research, it's not online, but now it is. I had to go down to the Harold Washington Library and spend the whatever. It was a fun day flipping through microfiches. The WPA, the Works Progress Administration, had translated 60 foreign language papers that were published here in Chicago. Throughout all the different ethnic groups and different things, but they translated a number of Yiddish papers. And the Yiddish papers had articles on different things that were going on, so I basically scanned through all these Yiddish papers looking for, the names of the Rabbanim that were on the list to learn information. The Daily Jewish Courier said that Torah, Lamdas, Haskalah, Chachma, Snias, Yerushimayim, and all other good traits of character. And Rabbi Yaakov Galinsky. A lot of what we learned from Rabbi Yaakov Galinsky, he had a Talmud who wrote a little bit of biographical information about him. He was blind in one eye for most of his life. And in 1921, he lost all of his vision. So for 12 years, he couldn't see. And he had Talmidim who would learn them, who would read with them, and he would teach them as he would go on. Right, again, known to be the greatest Lamdan in the entire city. There was once a story where somebody had to get presented with an award. So the principal of the school said, you have to say something. It's not enough to say thank you. You can't just get up and say thank you. So he said, well, what am I supposed to say? So the principal said, I don't know, ask Rabbi Yaakov Galinsky. Ask Rabbi Galinsky. So he went to Rabbi Yaakov Dolinsky. So he said, well, what Gemara are you learning? So he said, oh, we're learning Kiddushin. So he said, oh, you know what you should say? You should say over the Gemara about Lididi Chazili, about that this award, basically say the following, say that this award that I'm getting, it's not to me, not just the award, but it's worth a lot more to me. He was able to respond to anybody and everywhere, right? It's just, we can't fathom, who Rabbi Yaakov Dolinsky was. Now, on some level, I think we all maybe know somebody who could fit these characteristics. Yes?
Where did he live?
Chicago.
But
I don't know. I don't know what neighborhood. At that time in 1917, the entirety, everybody lived on the west side, the Maxwell Street area. I think he lived in the Maxwell Street area.
Well, Sawyer is like...
Right, now he wasn't in the Sawyer Avenue, Michelle. Yeah. That was the other one. Okay, moving along. We have Rabbi Epstein, Rabbi Zriel Epstein. Okay? Rabbi Zriel Epstein was 45 years old in 1917. Okay. He was previously a Rav in Russia in a city called Kharkov. And a number of people from his community had ended up moving to Chicago. And they kept imploring him, please come to Chicago, be our rabbi, be our Rav. And he, didn't really want to, but again, he knew that Russia wasn't the most hospitable place, and he kept the ticket. They sent him a ticket to come to Chicago, to America. He kept the ticket in his pocket for a year until he decided to come and join them and to be their Rav. He came to Chicago in 1899. He became the Rav of what ended up becoming called a merging of two shuls, but Beis Medrash HaGadol v'nei Yaakov Anshei Luknik. He was the Rav of that shul for 37 years. He was the Rav Machshir of Sinai Kosher. Familiar with that? Sinai Kosher. And he, one of his accomplishments, he said, was that he stopped them shipping meat. They used to ship meat out on Shabbos. He said, you can't ship kosher meat out on Shabbos. He put his foot down. Obviously, he's somebody who had his build, his persona was one of eminence, of showing off Rabbanis, of... you can see here he had a cane. He was somebody important. This story was something similar, which probably happened to many rabbonim. But the story was told about him that he went to one of the butcher shops to inspect. And as he walked into the door, the owner of the store pulled out a revolver, told him to get out. Well, he got out, but that he probably lost his kosher certificate or whatever they had in those days. What? He had the respect. He held the respect of all the rabbanim in the city, all the rabbis. He became the head of what at that time was the Merkaz HaRabbanim, the community group of rabbanim. They said that he was a lion. He was a lion who raised the prestige of Kavod HaTorah and Kavod Rabbanim in the city. That fact was shown. How prestigious was he? That at his Levaya in 1938, not only were there Hespedim from the Rabbanim of the time, of Rabbi Korb, Rabbi Small, Rabbi Olshuing, Rabbi Goldman, Rabbi Gordon, but also Mayor Edward Kelly spoke at his funeral. And at that time, the Jewish governor, Henry Horner, also sent in his condolences in a telegram. He was somebody who was moser nefesh, moser gufo v'nafsho. He gave over his entire body and being for the matters of Torah, Judaism, and the community here in Chicago. I one time interviewed Rabbi Small, Oliver Shalom. Rabbi Small said, "Oh, Rabbi Epstein, he was the power. He was the power." Right, that's, you know, I can't really formulate that into a proper sentence, but he was the power, really can formulate Rabbi Epstein. So going from Rabbi Epstein to Rabbi Epstein, what?
I'm assuming that we wouldn't have had there, but that was his show. Where would that have been?
Which one? The one on the right or the one on the left?
The one on the right.
The one on the right. I don't remember the exact address. I don't know. It's all in the, it's on the west side. It's all on the west side. All these shuls, the architecture of these shuls is, they don't build shuls like this anymore. The majority of these shuls are either, I mean, almost all of them are not, are either churches or are knocked down. They're edifices. They're monstrous edifices. Okay, going from Rabbi Epstein to Rabbi Epstein, and again, similar architecture here, is Rabbi Ephraim Epstein. Rabbi Ephraim Epstein is definitely a lot more well-known than Rabbi Zriel Epstein. Rabbi Ephraim Epstein was only here in Chicago for 6 years in 1917. Rabbi Ephraim Epstein was born in Slobodka. He got smicha again from the Ritvaz. He got smicha from the Aruch HaShulchan, from Rabbi Baruch Kamai in the Mir. His brother was Rabbi Moshe Mordechai Epstein. Rabbi Moshe Mordechai Epstein was the Rosh Yeshiva of Slobodka Yeshiva and ended up moving a large contingency of the yeshiva off to Hebron. To Eretz Yisrael, move the whole, not the whole yeshiva, but a large majority of the yeshiva off to Hebron. Hebron is now in Givat Mordechai in Yerushalayim. A Slobodka yeshiva, but the yeshiva that he moved it's called the Hebron yeshiva now. The shul that he came to, Rabbi Ephraim Epstein, came in 1911. Anshei Knesset Israel, obviously was the largest shul in the city at that time. That building was actually knocked down, I was 3 or 4 years ago only. It was a church and it was condemned, whatever, the different discussion. But it held 3,500 people, right? It had 3,500 people. Hopefully they collected membership from all those people, but we'll see. He had an aristocratic bearing to him, his demeanor. He was called the conscience of the Chicago Orthodox Jewish community. 100 years ago on Chol HaMoed Sukkos, a little bit less, almost, it'll be 100 years, in 1917, in his sukkah, there was a meeting of Rabbonim. Rabbi Cardone was there, who we mentioned, Rabbi Rubinstein, who we're going to get to, Rabbi Greenberg was there, and the meeting focused on the need to establish a formal yeshiva here in the city. It took them 5 years, but they ended up creating Beis Medrash HaTorah, Hebrew Theological College, the Chicago Yeshiva, which is now here in Skokie. He raised tremendous amounts of money. He was one of the best. He was a best speaker. He was the best fundraiser. They say that he was involved with relief after World War I. You know, the situation in Europe, especially among the yeshivas, was a deplorable financial situation was tremendous, and he took a lot of that on his shoulders. They say that he personally raised over $1 million for yeshivas and Torah institutions in Europe. Right? Somebody would raise today $1 million is a lot of money. In 100 years ago, to raise $1 million is a tremendous thing. He was the president of the ATT for over 10 years. He was loyal to the Mizrahi. He was in the Vada Poyel. He was on the Vada Yeshivas. He was involved with founding not only the Yeshiva, the ATT, the Chicago Jewish Academy. One point we did mention that his brother was involved with founding the Yeshiva in Hebron. In 1929, we know there was a tremendous amount of riots and massacres in Hebron. Rabbi Epstein's son was killed in those riots, Rabbi Aaron David. He was murdered in those massacres in Europe. At that time, also one of his chavrimen in Hebron, one of his friends, David Winchester, was I would say he was murdered, but he lived, and he survived. He survived the massacres and became one of the holy tzaddikim who passed through our city. But he wasn't here in 1917 as a rav, so he's not part of this discussion, right? We have to, you know. That's who it is. Somebody who we don't know. Oh, so here's a quick photo of the building that he ended up building. You know, he was involved with. This is a building of on the west side, the Hebrew Theological College. If you look, the Chicago Jewish Academy is. I think that's behind it, right?
Okay. At the beginning, I think it was they used the building.
It wasn't. Yeah, there was a different building at the end. Okay, Rabbi Glick. Rabbi Glick again is somebody we don't know much about. Rabbi Shua Glick. He was born in 1860 in the hometown of Rav Yitzchak Cook, and it seems like they were chavrusas for a time. That we do know. In 1895, Rabbi Tichtin had already been in Chicago. He was serving in the chevr shatz of the shul that they were in, and at that time, the rav, one of the earlier rabbanim of the city, Rav Tudras Tichtin. Ended up moving to Eretz Yisrael, and Rabbi Glick became the Rav of the Shul. This is the Marian Polar Shul, Oyev Shalom. The eventual building of the Shul still stands. This is at the corner of Ashland and Polk, basically right next to Rush University Hospital. Again, Nebuchadnezzar Church. I actually met somebody who is a congregant there, a non-Jewish person, and he told me that even though the building was actually only used as a shul for a very short amount of time, probably about 10 years. But he said there's still plaques on all the seats with the names of the people whose seats they were. So we spoke before about uncompromising for Yiddishkeit. They said that Rabbi Glick understood the people of his shul and that they wanted to conform with the times. A different perspective. So what do they do? What do they allow in his shul? In his shul, they allowed men to come to shul with straw hats. That was the leniency. They allowed men to come to shul with straw hats. And if you know the history of the Marian Polar shul, it ended up creating, there was a whole machlekes. I don't remember the exact name of the original shul, but basically the shul split off because a guy came to shul and they wouldn't let him daven with his straw hat. And he got upset and he left. And Rabbi Glick said, it's okay, it's fine. It's fine, I'll be progressive in doing that. Rabbi Glick ended up dying in 1925, and he also is buried here in Chicago in Waldheim Cemetery. Okay. They have more time, right? Plenty of time. Rabbi Shalom Israel's son, I was introduced to him, he came across a number of his svarim. It seemed that he printed three or four svarim. It seems like they didn't have printing presses here in Chicago. So a lot of svarim were printed in either St. Louis or in Milwaukee. But at that time, he was a rav here in Chicago. He was born in 1861, and he learned under Yisrael Salanter, the head of the Musar movement. He came to Chicago in 1900 after being in Milwaukee for 16 years. Rabbi Israelson did not bow to any pressure He said to modernize his shul. Now, just an interesting quote, just because we are dealing with Thanksgiving today. In the middle of his introduction, he says, you know, one of the reasons why he wanted to write this book is because it's makom asher sfurim shama kol shchonos chemdenu umamono kol machmadenu aval man nechze bebeis Yehudus beadmas Columbus. What are we going to say about the Judaism in the land of Columbus? Right? That's what he called America. He called America the land of Columbus. He was a warrior. Rabbi Israelson was a warrior. They said that he wrote Sfarim because he wanted there to be evidence of Torah Judaism in Chicago, in America. He was not confident that Torah Judaism would survive here in America. And he said, well, listen, let's at least show people what used to be and what there was. He watched that the Reform and Conservative grew in their strength here in Chicago. And he was disheartened that tradition was, that you know, that traditional Judaism was not going to endure. Baruch Hashem, we could say 100 years later that traditional Judaism has endured and has flourished. So at least that should be, a solace for him. You know, he kind of felt a little bit aloof from the people, that people didn't understand. He was trying to tell people that we have to wake up, and people weren't as attentive as he would have liked. okay, Rabbi Rubinstein. Rabbi Rubinstein has a, let's go like this. Rabbi Rubinstein was moved to Chicago in 1917. So he was 45 years old. He moved to Chicago. His wife was a niece of Reb Tzadok HaKohen from Lublin. He moved there to Israel around 1900. And he was a member of Reb Shmuel Salant's Beis Din in Yerushalayim. He was sent in 1917 to raise funds and was kidnapped or captured by the people of B'nai Reuven, the shul. I mean, they didn't kidnap him, but they convinced him, which was basically a common way of recruiting Rabbanim. Rabbanim would come around and they would say, you know what, instead of raising funds, we'll give you a salary, stay here. Right? And whatever, they convinced him, and he ended up moving here in 1917. In 1919, 2 years later, he founded a small yeshiva that met in his home, and again, that part of that became the yeshiva. He was involved in that meeting on Cholamoed Sukkot. He was of sterling character and was just a warm person. You can see from the picture of him giving shir. One of the few pictures we have of old former yeshivas in the yeshiva giving shir. They're basically sitting on the edge of their seats, listening to every word that he's saying. What? He was a huge Talmud Chacham. He was. We didn't get there yet. He was running the whole farm. He was barrel. He was Rosh Hashiva in the yeshiva for over 20 years. He was a member of an organization that I never heard of, Agudas B'nai Eretz Yisrael. What was Agudas B'nai Eretz Yisrael? Agudas B'nai Eretz Yisrael was an organization in Chicago which gave support to people who moved here to Chicago from Eretz Yisrael. So he was involved with that. And he had, just the flip side, he had great confidence that Torah Judaism would flourish in Chicago. The total opposite perspective. He was confident, and he said, even though it looks like it's not so good, it's going to be great. It's going to be wonderful. And His grandson was Beryl Wein. That's okay. So even though his shul, even though the shul that he was, B'nai Reuven, was a Lubavitch shul, he himself was not. That's just how it was.
Not all the Rabbam were Lubavitch, but it was
The shul was a Nusach Ari shul. Yeah. Right, it was a Nusach Ari shul. One of his students, I don't know who this is, Yosef Rinov, he said to us, I'll just read the quote. We can get a little bit more on who he was, who Rabbi Rubinstein was, and who maybe we should try to emulate this even. To most of us, he was the only man within our experience who crystallized and concretized our idea of the ideal Jew. We did not have to picture our ideal as a composite of this man's learning and this man's deeds. In this one man, our ideal was realized. Right? He was basically everything they could have dreamed of. He was he was wonderful, right? And that's Rabbi Rubinstein. And I think there are still some people. He died in 1944. There may be some people still around who have at least remembrances or parents who learned under Rabbi Rubinstein.
Was he at Bnei Reuben until 44?
I think so. I think so. I don't know.
When the Prediker Rebbe came.
It's possible. I have to double check when Rabbi Schusterman came and how that worked.
The Friedeker Rebbe came in what, 1941?
Well, I don't know. I don't know. The original, the previous Rebbe. Right, okay. Just because we're running short on time, I ran into a problem of each one of the Rabbanim that was here in the city. We could talk more and more about who was here in 1917. So I said, you know what? Let's cut our losses. Let's at least mention their names. Rabbi Dov Astrakhan, if you look, on there's two pictures over there. The picture on the left is Rabbi Yosef Dov Astrakhan. That's Rabbi Goldson. The next picture, the picture on the right, is Rabbi Chana Chaimovitz. He had a bookstore. Rabbi Winograd, Rabbi Yaakov Greenberg. There's actually a picture of Rabbi Yaakov Greenberg standing in front of the original Eight Sky Yeshiva. It's kind of hard to see him. That's Rabbi Yaakov Greenberg. Yaakov Greenberg was involved in the administration of the yeshiva. He had a very interesting life. He was a scientist, and he did not work on Shabbos, and he ended up becoming the administrator of the yeshiva, and he helped orchestrate a lot of the growth. Shmuel Rawarovsky, Rav Nassim Bezinski, Rav Shmuel Shach, we'll talk about him a little bit. Yitzhak Kramer, he was also a Rebbe who also was not able to see, but was a well-known Rebbe at that time. Yaakov Levinskin, Gershon Licht. Rav Shalom Miles lived over 100 years. Rav Shalom Yedidyah Shachat. I just mentioned Rav Shalom Yedidyah Shachat for a minute. He was a Rav here a number of times. This actually is one of his Svarim. In the back, there's a listing of all the people who sponsored the Sefer. So that helped us a little bit in the research of finding who was here in the city at that time a little bit. He mentioned an interesting case, an interesting Shaila, which he had, which is at least an interesting perspective that we see, at least halachically, in Chicago. He said it seems to him that the custom in America, the custom in Chicago, is that not all synagogues face east, right? A lot of the synagogues face to the north or to the south. It seems, you know, even nowadays, even after the shuls move from the west side to West Rogers Park to the north side or whatever, a lot of that custom seemed to have emerged. For whatever reasons, they don't face to the east. And his shaila was that the Beis Medrash of the shul that he was in faced east and the main synagogue room faced to the north. And he wanted to know if there was a problem of two shuls davening in two different directions at the same time under one roof. Is there a problem of losis godo? It's a very interesting shaila, especially in light of the fact that we see this custom emerging even today, where, you know, the way that synagogues were built. Rav Shmuel Shach, just to mention Rav Shmuel Shach for a minute, was born in 1917. He was the Rav of Kehilas Yaakov Shul. Kehilas Yaakov, the building actually still stands today, was recently remodeled. Nebuch, it's a church. His shul sat only 1,800 people. It was a smaller shul. Sat only 1,800 people. And it had a very strong Chevr Shas, 25 people that were involved. He believed very strongly in Jewish education. And he helped also organize the Rabbanis. A remembrance of Rabbi Shmuel Shach exists today. He said his shul was Kehilas Yaakov. He was Jacob. The shul moved to Peterson Park and is known as now as Kehilas Yaakov Beth Shmuel, Beth Samuel, for Rabbi Shmuel Shach in his honor. So the KJBS, he's the Beth Shmuel on that. And again, it would be entirely remiss to discuss Rabbanim here in Chicago without mentioning Rabbi Saul Silber, architect basically of Hebrew Theological College of Silk Yeshiva, a tremendously fluent speaker and orator. He was the first president of the yeshiva. Also, he helped found the Chicago Jewish Academy and the library, which he held a tremendous interest, is named after him, the Saul Silber Library, of which this project helped us catapult being the largest borrower of books from the library, and that's it. So that's basically at least Rabbi Muskin. Rabbi Muskin was a Rav in second, I just want to make sure I get confused here. Rabbi Muskin was the Rav of Bnei David, was Bnei David Shul, ended up becoming the Rav in Beis Medrash HaGadol Anshei Dorim in 1919. But in 1917, he was convinced by Rav Meir Berlin to take a break in from the active Rabbanis and to become more involved in the Mizrahi, and to help focus more on Eretz Yisrael. Again, the world that existed back then is totally different from the world which we have now. And even though we have what's called Mizrahi now, it seemed that it was an entirely different type of organization with focuses that are somewhat different. Obviously, still in Eretz Yisrael, but a little bit different than what we have now. He was active in the Varat Sala and the Gudas HaRabbanim, especially involved with modernizing the chicken shechting, chicken slaughtering here in Chicago, and making improvements that basically made the chicken slaughtering kosher again. Lohi siyor lehisnagid. He did not hold himself to be haughty and to go against people. Mu'ur of Bein Abris, that he said that he was involved with other people. So he was able to hold his composure. His son is now a famous Rav out in L.A., the Young Israel of Century City. His grandson, sorry. Also named Rebbe Lezer. Right, named after his grandfather. Right, his grandson, thank you. Right. Okay, that is a picture of some of the Rabbanim, some of the activities that were going on here in Chicago. Yes. Yeah. Sure. Yeah, I could talk about him. Rabbi Menachem B. Sachs was the son-in-law of Sri Pesach Frank, of Hirsch Pesach Frank, as Schwartz says, or Hirsch Pesach. He ended up moving here, I think it was in the 40s. He became the head of the ATT. He was their fundraiser. Hold on.